Country. Boris Chassagne here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's Viewpoints, a recent survey finds that more Canadians are living beyond their means. Inflation and high interest rates are for many becoming unbearable.
We are seeing the numbers come down. We're just living through some pretty historic times.
In British Columbia, Premier David Eby is taking the bull by the horns with legislation to regulate short-term rentals.
We need those units for people who help make the province go.
In Quebec, as students take to the streets to protest increases to tuition fees, which would affect out-of-province undergraduate and professional master's students. They're looking at a $17,000 tuition bill per year as soon as next fall.
There's definitely a lot of discomfort with, like, I don't know, discrimination against, like, English-speaking communities, English-speaking people. It's really hard to be included into the Quebec identity as an English-speaking person, even though I've lived here for, like, 8 or 9 years now. So that's been a bit, like, heartbreaking for me at times to see.
Alberta announces long-term investments into Indigenous infrastructure.
Today is about empowering Indigenous communities. It's about making their aspirations and economic independence a reality.
In Nova Scotia, NDP opposition is asking Premier Tim Houston to cut grocery tax on all food items.
It's just harder and harder to make ends meet. That this is, you know, one small step the government can take that would make a difference for folks.
Welcome to Viewpoint. Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. We start things off in British Columbia, where a recent survey finds that more Canadians are living beyond their means. They are paying more of their income towards housing, partly because high interest rates is driving up some mortgage payments. The survey conducted by Léger for the online mortgage marketplace called RateFilter shows that 60% of Canadians are spending 37% of their income on housing. Moreover, 51% say if they lost their main source of income, they would default on their mortgage payments after a few months. Megan Dooling explores the reasons behind the survey's conclusions and what they mean for people in Revelstoke, BC and beyond. She spoke with Andy Hill, a co-founder of RateFilter based in Vancouver, British Columbia.
We did this survey to kind of test the waters and see, you know, how Canadian homeowners were being impacted by this really remarkable interest rate change over the past 18 months. Policymakers and the Bank of Canada, I mean, the Bank of Canada kind of has a very blunt tool to impact the economy. And they're really trying their very best to keep inflation under control. We are seeing the numbers come down, which is one of the reasons why the forward markets are pricing in no more rate increases and some rate cuts here coming in 2024 and 2025. We're just living through some pretty historic times, and it's really good to kind of calculate the data and kind of see the sentiment at some of these things that may be close to a top on the interest rates for now.
Like, do we just ride this out, or is there things that could be done that could help people and the economy out?
Well, I think increasing supply, housing supply, is probably the biggest lever that policymakers could pull on. You know, one of the problems is, and I mean, you guys see it in Revelstoke, is that there's not a lot of area to build, right? You're constrained by a lot of park and forest land around. And so there's only so much supply that can be brought onto the market to try to alleviate some of this issue. We see a similar thing here in Vancouver, where there's not a lot of extra area to build, and the costs to build are quite high. It's all very dynamic, and over time, the market kind of balances itself out for better or for worse. But I think policymakers, as well as the Bank of Canada, they only have certain kind of levers to pull on. There's not a lot they can do that can impact things immediately, but they can certainly kind of push on what they can to try to alleviate some of this pressure that's kind of built in the housing market today.
You mentioned we're living in historic times, and that's one of the reasons that you wanted these survey, these data to kind of mark that. You know, it's not great living through historic times. But can you just, because I know I asked my parents, there was a recession in the 80s, how did interest rates compare? And I think they were at 18% or something like this. Businesses were closing. How is this different historically than that time, aside from the fact that the interest rates aren't that high?
Yeah, I think when you compare this, you know, cycle to what happened in kind of that late 80s, early 90s moment, is that debt levels are so much higher than they were at that time. So I think when you make that, like when we look at that comparison, it actually is pretty comparative in the sense that, you know, a house might cost $150,000 at that point in time, but now we're talking about housing at over $1 million in some cases, and we're seeing a lot of mortgages close to $1 million. So, you know, when we look at that, you know, it can be relative in the sense that we've seen such an increase to interest rates, and with debt levels being so high, not only for consumers, but for governments and for corporations. I mean, debt levels are at kind of all-time highs. So the impact of the higher rates should really help bring down just some of the demand, which is really all they're trying to do. And once they see that, they can start to lower them accordingly.
This is an interview with Andy Hill about the high cost of living.
Generally speaking, unemployment would need to increase further for us to be in a recession, like a standard recession. But when you do look at a lot of the consumer spending, it has gone down a lot. And the retail sales numbers have gone down a lot. And so it is speaking to the fact that we are close to, if not in, recession already. And the tough thing is that a lot of those things will kind of be looked back on. You usually don't really know where you are until you reposition yourself, over time. So it's almost like if you're at the top of a mountain and you're looking down, your perspective looks very different than if you're looking at, you know, the bottom of the mountain looking up. And, you know, when we were in the low of the cycle during the pandemic, no one really saw the inflation, but the inflation was there and it was starting and it was bubbling. And that's almost like where we are right now, where we're close to the end of this cycle, and it's pushing all of those higher interest rates are really having their impact on the economy. But until we really start to see something break or something turn or, you know, some more headlines on it, we won't really know that we maybe were here now. What we'll be able to do is in 2025 and 2026, potentially look back on this moment as, you know, hopefully a short-term cycle that we all kind of lived through.
Would it be possible with this change to actually see wages go up to match the cost of living?
Yeah, I think that we're starting to see that with union agreements and other things that kind of permeate through. That's one of the issues that the Bank of Canada is really trying to keep under wraps, is that inflation can have this spiral effect, and we are seeing that today, where, you know, if individuals are feeling the pinch, they then go to their employers and they say they need to be paid more. Their employers then pay them more and therefore need to charge more for their goods and services. And so that is a spiral that can sometimes get a bit out of control. It's one of the reasons why they're really trying to kind of put a lid on this thing as quickly as they can, such that individuals don't have to change a lot of what happens day to day, and therefore the employers and corporations don't need to charge more for their goods and services, which kind of creates that spiral.
Do you think that raising the interest rates like the Bank of Canada has over the past 18 months, do you think it was the right response to the type of inflation that we are seeing?
It's so hard to say, because they kind of have they've got like a screwdriver to hammer in a nail, and they're really doing their best. but they just don't have all of the levers that they wish they had in order to make change across Canada. And then, you know, there's a number of central banks from the US to the European Union to the UK, and they all are kind of doing a similar thing. And so in terms of what we had to do to preserve our currency against the US dollar and against the euro and those sorts of things, the Bank of Canada really had to follow suit to a certain degree in order to kind of keep the global playing field all connected and together. So, you know, given where we came from, it was probably prudent. I think the one thing that everyone missed was that they should have started to raise rates sooner, and that probably would have allowed them to keep rates slightly lower than where they've gone today. I think things got a bit out of control, and then they had to act very quickly, which really impacted how high they had to go overall.
Andy Hill is a co-founder of RateFilter, based in Vancouver. I'm Megan Dooling.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
The government of Alberta announced on October 30th that they are expanding the Alberta Indigenous Opportunities Corporation's loan guarantee from its current $1 billion to $2 billion. It will also increase again to $3 billion next year. The AIOC, launched in 2019, has provided more than $500 million in investments to nearly 30 Indigenous communities in Alberta. The announced expansion will reduce the cost of borrowing and increase the amount that can be borrowed by Indigenous communities, according to the government. More on this announcement with Ryan Hunt in Edmonton.
The government of Alberta announced that the Alberta Indigenous Opportunities Corporation, or AIOC, will receive a boost in loan guarantees from its current $1 billion to $2 billion. Next year, it will increase again to $3 billion, all for the purpose of improving infrastructure in Indigenous communities across the province. Shauna Martineau, the CEO of the AIOC, spoke in a press conference and shared how important this expansion is.
This truly is a historic day. I am honored to stand before you today to highlight the transformational impact that the AIOC Loan Guarantee Program has provided for Indigenous communities in our province. Since 2019, in 4 short years, we have helped 27 Indigenous communities invest over $500 million in large-scale infrastructure projects in our province. The benefits from these programs directly impact over 61,000 people. Today is about empowering Indigenous communities. It's about making their aspirations and economic independence a reality.
Rick Wilson, the Minister of Indigenous Relations, explained what kind of impact the AIOC has had since its inception in 2019.
The AIOC is breaking down barriers. The Federal Indian Act doesn't enable First Nations to use their land as collateral. Now, this makes it very difficult and hard for them to borrow money for some of these projects. By providing these loan guarantees, the AIOC helps create those opportunities that didn't exist before. And boy, has it ever made a game changer for Indigenous economic inclusion. Including Indigenous people in every level of the economy is a huge part of our push towards economic reconciliation.
According to Chief Cody Thomas of Enoch Cree Nation, this expansion will mean the world for not only the current generation, but for generations to come.
These transformative agreements usher in diversity and boundless opportunity for Indigenous communities. Reconciliation is a journey of concrete actions, and from an economic perspective, this expansion represents a substantial stride towards a brighter future for our people. I'm genuinely thrilled about the potential that lies ahead. Together, we can forge a more equitable and prosperous future for all.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang. Log in to canadainfo.ca to get all our stories.
Interest rates, inflation, lack of social and affordable housing, and financial precarity are all putting pressure on governments and Canadians across the country. In British Columbia, Premier David Eby recently spoke at the State of the Island Economic Summit in Nanaimo, calling the lack of rental housing a drag on the provincial economy. In hopes of providing some relief to the crisis, the Premier is now taking the bull by the horns and introduced legislation to regulate short-term rentals. More on this with Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, BC.
This is just a reality when you have a vacancy rate of less than 1%, when it's a drag on the provincial economy, the fact that people can't find housing. And we literally have strata buildings where 70 and 80% of the units in them are short-term rentals. And the net effect, whether it's a series of individuals with a single investment unit or one individual with 70 investment units, is the same, which is that we need those units for people who help make the province go.
The Premier says the province is buying up land around transit corridors to build affordable middle-income housing and is looking to partner with municipalities for innovative solutions.
We've had a lot of municipalities come forward and say, we've got land, we'd love to work with you. We want to put housing above our fire station. We want to put housing above our city hall. We want to put housing above a local school, the school boards. We have health authorities who want to put housing for healthcare workers on hospital grounds. And the momentum behind this is very significant. And I do think ultimately it will be quite transformative as we get back into the business of making sure that the middle class actually has a place to live.
And to Montreal, Quebec, where the Coalition Avenir Québec's proposed tuition hike is not going unchallenged. The government continues to face the backlash over the measures it announced for out-of-province students wishing to study at English universities. On October 30th, hundreds of students took to the streets to protest the doubling of out-of-province tuition, which is slated to affect incoming undergraduate and professional master's students next fall. They all met at the symbolic downtown Dorchester Square and marched towards McGill's University Roddick Gates. It wasn't just students at Monday's protest. Professors and community members also came out in solidarity with out-of-province students. Students had the harshest words for Higher Education Minister Pascal Derry and the CAG government. Jules Bugel was on location in Montreal.
On a rainy, snowy Monday, hundreds of students and supporters gathered in downtown Dorchester Square. They were there to show their opposition to the CAC's plan to double out-of-province tuition.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm Alexandre Achke. I'm the president of the SMU. So we're protesting the tuition hikes. The red square is an old symbol of tuition hike protesting in Montreal. It comes originally from 2009, it was reused and a big success in 2012 during the Maple Spring protests. So it represents education for all, education that is accessible and that is free. And this is what we're fighting for.
The government's line is that they're trying to curb some of the, you know, they're trying to protect the French language. How do you feel about this? Like, do you think that this is an effective way? Like, how would you respond to those concerns?
This protest is not about language. We stand in solidarity with UQAM. This is a protest about the tuition hikes and the right to education. These measures are going to do nothing to protect French. They're going to damage the access to education of students, and that is all. This is a class problem more than it is a language problem.
Many in attendance were from Bishop's University. About a third of their students are out of province. Without the international reputation of McGill, it'll be harder to pivot to international admissions. Students like Erica say that although they won't be paying more, they'll see the impact of these changes as budget cuts affect the quality of their education.
So I was born here in Quebec. It doesn't even affect me personally. However, we're a 2,500 student university. We don't have the same capacity as the main Quebec universities or even here in Montreal, the other English universities. And my friends, some of them are out of province. My roommates are international students, and those are affected. And with the fact that we would lose 50% of our out of province students on top top of the Bill 96, which already compromised French students coming to English universities, this could literally bankrupt fully the university and not simply become an issue for out-of-province or international students, but also increase our own tuition as Quebec students to compromise for the lack of money that happened due to this law being put in place.
Yeah, so, I mean, at this protest right now, there's a lot of purple. There's a lot of people from Bishop. So, like, what is the feeling among the student body right now, would you say?
Right now, it's a lot of anger, a lot of misunderstanding as well. The fact that the government basically spoke about this without even speaking to the universities first, that we just, as students, learned it through the news, and we were the one contacting our own university, being what's going on, and that even them did not know what was happening, made us actually extremely angry against the government and against what's happening. It feels like it's segregation. It feels like it's targeting a minority of the population. And it just feels like it's attacking our friends, it's attacking our own family, and we have to just all stand together no matter what.
Isabelle Odette is a Bishop's grad from Alberta with a Quebecois dad. Now she's making a life for herself in Quebec as a social worker in Nunavik. She says Bishop's helped her integrate into the province, but there are still challenges that Anglophones face.
Arriving in, like, the bus in Arras was definitely a bit tough for me. I did have an accent and all that, and I did want to, like, I had a lot of Quebec pride being half Quebecer myself. And I was ready to go to a French-Canadian, like, university as well. But when I found Bishop's, I found really, like, a beautiful community to come integrate to, and a community that is incredibly proud to be both red and blue. That's our purple spirit that comes out through there. And yeah, it's a beautiful English community to integrate that gives you access to the beautiful culture of, like, French-Canadian Quebec as well. And now I'm working in the marginalized community in the north, trying to give back to Quebec in the way that it gave to me. So, but I felt pretty confident going through Quebec as, like, a bilingual individual. It's been pretty easy for me for that reason, but I think there's definitely a lot of discomfort with, like, I don't know, discrimination against, like, English-speaking communities, English-speaking people. It's really hard to be included into the Quebec identity as an English-speaking person, even though I've lived here for, like, 8 or 9 years now, and I have a lot of family here in Quebec as well. Like, I know that the way that it's directed, the way the CAC is trying to work, they're really trying to make the Quebec identity super duper exclusive. So that's been a bit, like, heartbreaking for me at times to see. But all the folks here that really care about this community, it's definitely a warm thing to see.
It wasn't just students at Monday's protest. Profs like Benjamin Fung said the changes will have far-reaching effects on universities like McGill.
So obviously we think that it's not fair to increase the tuition fee of the other province students by doubling it. It takes around 200 years for us to build a reputation of a university. We have this reputation is not just because we have good faculty members, but also because of the high quality of students. As a professor, we are taking the best students from the world, not only from Canada. So if we have to make this unfair adjustment on the tuition, it means that we are not taking the best student.
As the department chair of Concordia, I've been to a lot of meetings about this over the last week, but I have nothing to say to you about this far so you don't already know. Everyone already knows that the entire university network of Quebec has been underfunded for decades.
Shame!
Yes, everyone already knows that this new tuition hike is just another effort to weaken not only higher education, but public services across the board.
Shame!
I could go through the details again as you've heard them and as you've read them, but to show again why it doesn't make sense, but when even the education minister barely bothers to justify it, what is the point? There is nothing but the government... There's nothing but his short-sightedness from stopping him from using his power today to invest in the promise that every single one of you represents. There is nothing but his greed stopping him from supporting your intelligence, your strength, and your courage for the benefit of all of this province. But the clear message that they have sent us, that they see you and all of the students and all of the universities in Quebec, all of whom are hurt by this, that they see you as a burden.
Shame!
And I think I speak for all of the faculty here today and in solidarity when I say that we all know from experience that you and all of the students at all of Quebec's universities are the future who make the real contributions. And that these parasites in the National Assembly who don't even understand their own funding models are the burden.
My name is Kennedy McDermott. I'm from British Columbia. I'm a student at McGill University. And I would not be here right now if my tuition cost $17,000 a year. When asked what lower enrollment as a result of doubling out-of-province tuition for students would mean for the economies of Montreal and Sherbrooke, Pascal Derry responded that, quote, they will keep on coming. I stand here today, as we all do, to tell Derry, Legault, and the Quebec government that they are all delusional.
I'm Jules Bijal with files from Sequoia Kim. Thanks for listening.
I'm sure we haven't heard the last from English-speaking university students, who, by the way, are also getting support from the French university students in the province. You can also check out Taylor McClure's story on Bishop's University protests. Over 187 regional leaders in the eastern townships came together to stand in solidarity with Bishop's University and to voice their concerns around the tuition increase for the out-of-province students wanting to study at Quebec English universities.
Hi, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
The Nova Scotia NDP is asking Premier Tim Houston to cut grocery tax on all food items. NDP leader Claudia Chender tabled legislation on October 31st in an effort to cut grocery tax to help Nova Scotians. Food prices from September 2022 to September 23 were up 6.2% in Nova Scotia compared to the national food price increase, which was 5.9%. More on this with Haley DiRizio in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
What we hear from people right across the province, certainly in our constituency office, is that it's just harder and harder to make ends meet. And in particular, I think almost everyone who buys food has noticed that the price of food has more than doubled in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's becoming more and more difficult. Now, the basics in our grocery stores aren't taxed, but there are an awful lot of things that are. And so for single folks, for seniors, for, you know, people working a 12-hour day on their lunch break, they're going to the grocery store to buy smaller items, prepared foods, many of the items that might have been untaxable as grocery are becoming taxed as the portion sizes get smaller and the prices rise. Mm-hmm. So there are still a lot of things at the grocery store that have a sales tax on them. And we think that, you know, in order to just help people to be able to afford to eat, we know that Nova Scotia got an F from Food Banks Canada in terms of poverty and food insecurity, that this is, you know, one small step the government can take that would make a difference for folks. Always looking. I think as a party, we are always looking for ways to help people to survive and to thrive and to be able to do well in our beautiful province. You know, there may be other tax measures. You know, one of the things that we have proposed is cutting seniors and family pharmacare fees. That's not a tax, but as we wait for a national pharmacare program, which has been promised, we know that people are choosing between food and medicine. And we know that that's, number one, an impossible choice that no one should have to make, but one that, again, really impacts people's health directly.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to Megan Dooling, Jules Bugiel, Mick Sweetman, Brian Hunt, and Haley DiRizio, National Coordinators Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Thanks for staying with us. Please stay tuned to the show that follows. Have a great week. Until the next time.
Listen to all our news online. at canada-invo.ca.